You're listening to an IOE podcast,
powered by UCL Minds.
This is Research for the Real World. Conversations with researchers about the paths they've taken to shape our everyday lives.
This is Research for the Real World. Hi, I'm Emily McLeod and I'm a PhD researcher at IOE, UCL's Faculty of Education and Society. In this season of Research for the Real World, we're highlighting IOE research that provides insights on finding ways for technology to play a meaningful role within education. We know that parents, teachers, and students have concerns about the way in which society reacts with technology, but how can we improve our relationship with it? Maximise the use of high-quality content? Is there a way we can take advantage of personalised learning? There's also all that chat about AI. On this episode, I'm delighted to be talking to Dr. Laura Uthwaite. Laura is a fellow co-host of the Research for the Real World podcast and is a senior research fellow at the Centre for Education Policy and Equalising Opportunities here at IOE. She's also deputy director of the Child Development and Learning Difficulties Lab and is a research fellow for the LEAP program funded by the Jacobs Foundation and MIT Solve. Laura's interdisciplinary work spans developmental psychology, education, and innovation in different educational, cultural, and economic contexts. Her research focuses on how educational technology can support learning outcomes. In her current work, Laura is considering what makes an effective educational maths app and how maths apps can support young children's mathematical development. This research is designed to help policymakers as well as parents and teachers to make the best decisions for children surrounding the use of educational maths apps. Laura, I look forward to learning more about your work and welcome to the podcast, or should I say, welcome to being a guest on the podcast.
Thanks, Emily. It feels a bit strange to be on this side of the microphone, but I'm really excited to talk more about my research with you. So thanks for having me.
So before I ask you a bit more about your work now, I want to know more about your own education and your work background. So first of all, how did you become involved in working in education research?
It's an interesting question, and I love telling the story. So back when I was an undergrad at the University of Nottingham, I always said I'd never do a PhD and I'd never live in London, and yet I ended up doing exactly both of those things. So when I was doing my undergraduate degree, I used to also volunteer in one of the local primary schools close to the university, and it was during those sessions that I used to work one-to-one with a young boy that was having difficulties with his maths and his reading. And it was really fun, and it was really good, like a good way to get to know him and like get to know the educational system. But one of the things that really struck me that was that in ordinary lessons he was really struggling, but yet when we were doing our one-to-one sessions, which I did try to make as fun and as engaging as possible, and when we were playing our different games, he really responded, and he really, like, you know, showed much more of a love for learning. And he seemed, at least in the short time that we worked together, he seemed to show some improvements. And it sparked this interest in education that, you know, I hadn't, you know, when you kind of think, oh, what do I want to be when I'm older? You know, that kind of without sounding too, it sparked something in me that I knew that I wanted to make a difference, essentially. And then when, you know, fast forward a few years to then the end of my undergraduate degree.
And was this in psychology, your undergrad?
Yes, it was. Yes, psychology.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
And when you do an undergraduate degree in psychology, it's very broad. So, you know, you will cover things like child psychology, educational psychology, but you'll also cover things like biological psychology, you know, things like perception and action. And so, you know, you get a very solid foundation in lots of different areas of psychology. But then, you know, through working with him, I knew that I wanted to go into the more kind of educational child direction. But then fast forward to the end of my undergraduate degree, when I was doing my final year project, I approached one of my lecturers, Professor Nicola Pitchford, and essentially asked her if I could do a project with her, because I was really interested in this idea around trying to help children learn that were struggling. And at the time, Nikki was doing, she just started her research work in Malawi, where she'd partnered with an educational app company, who are now known as 1Billion. And I was still working in the school. And so we saw this perfect opportunity to try and do some similar work, but in the UK. So what started off as an undergraduate project with 26 children in the local school that I used to volunteer in, turned into a master's, a PhD, which then fed into an Education Endowment Foundation trial. So yeah, we've seen it very much from the beginning all the way through. And yeah, it's great to see that growth over a journey that started in 2013, I think.
Wow.
So yeah, Nikki convinced me successfully to do a PhD, to go back on my word. And I'm so glad that she did, because it opened my world and it opened so many new opportunities to me that I never thought that I could really ever have. And so for that, I am incredibly grateful. So yeah, I decided to stay at Nottingham. I did my PhD there, had an amazing opportunity to go to Brazil. I did some field work over there, evaluating the 1Billion apps,
wow,
which was a great experience. And like I say, we did a number of studies in the UK as well. But then after spending 7 years in Nottingham, I knew that it was time to leave or just pursue new opportunities and see where to go. And I remember very vividly seeing the job advert at IOE for a research associate in a new research centre, which is now the Centre for Education Policy and Equalising Opportunities. It was a 5-year position and I was very nervous to apply, but I knew that I had to at least give it a go. It was the first postdoc job I applied for and the only postdoc job I applied for.
Congratulations, that's some good art.
Yeah, one for one. So yeah, I was, very lucky to be able to make that step. And like I say, very grateful to all the mentors that I've had throughout the process. So like I say, now Dr. Laura Uthwaite and now live in London.
So yeah,
very, very strange how things happen. And sometimes it is, life goes in a way that you don't always expect it to. And so yeah, always grateful.
Absolutely. That's really interesting. Yeah, not only does it go in a way you don't expect, but that in the way that you were definitely not planning it.
Absolutely, right. Absolutely.
So how have you found being in London, given that it sounds like it wasn't at the start of that journey your first choice? Has London life attracted you? Has it been better than you thought?
Oh yeah, for sure. So one of my closest friends, he moved to London a few years before. So, we used to come down and visit him and we had a lot of fun. And, it was that kind of like, oh, actually, maybe it's not as bad as I thought. It's not as intimidating. And then when I moved down in 2018, like I moved with friends and, you just throw yourself into the new adventure. And yeah, it was great. And in terms of, being a kind of early career researcher in London, particularly at the IOE, like you've got such a big group of people that are doing very similar things to you. And so it was such a good way to like expand my network and meet other people that were working in my areas or slightly adjacent to. And so in that kind of way, I think it was, at least for me, it was a really good move.
Absolutely. And as you say, like IOE is so huge, so there's the chance to meet and work with so many different people, and your work sounds so interdisciplinary anyway, so it sounds like a great opportunity. Also, I want to acknowledge how lucky you were to get 5 years. That's the dream as an early career researcher, right? As someone coming to the end of my PhD, 5-year posts are like gold dust. So well done on that. I think it sounds like a great opportunity.
Yeah, it was. And again, like just incredibly grateful for it, because, when I first started, like my kind of the first 18 months I spent, getting to know other people. So, I had the chance to work at the UCL Knowledge Lab for a little bit. So I worked on their Educate project, which was essentially a program where I acted as a research mentor. I got partnered with edtech companies and would give them advice on their research methodologies and, kind of to think about how their programs could lead to change through things like logic models, and also give it like upskilling them in terms of research methods. So I got to expand into that more kind of edtech space. But then, I also got to know Dr. Jo van Hervagen, who's become one of my really close collaborators. There's also Birkbeck, so like there's the Center for Educational Neuroscience. So I remember going to, their weekly seminar series on a Thursday, which at the time was in person, and it was just a great way to just go up to people like, I really liked your talk, can we go for a coffee? And sometimes I think, it's great that we have all these online sessions as well, but I do miss the in-person ones where you can just kind of like throw yourself at people and be like, please let's meet. It's a nice introduction. That doesn't mean to say that obviously you can't do those kind of like networking opportunities. You just have to be a little bit more creative with things. But yeah, having those 5 years, you know, like I say, the first 18 months, I threw myself into getting to know different people, different projects, but also then applied for my first research grant as principal investigator, which again, my one for one didn't always maintain after this. I did manage to go two for two after that. Definitely did have a dip, but you know, after that grant, like, you know, I've tried to apply for additional funding, and it hasn't always been easy. That, you know, you definitely need to be able to persevere in academia, but by having those 5 years, it's given me that breathing room that when we haven't been successful with further grants, you know, I can pick myself up and be like, okay, let's try again, you know. And it's given me that breathing room to then also be like, okay, well, this year didn't work out, let's try again next year. You know, so hopefully we're coming towards the end. Hopefully something will stick, and no doubt it will. But yeah, it also just gives you that time to think, like, not just in terms of like the logistics in terms of applying for grants. It just gives you that space to be like, to think and develop your ideas, and to really, you know, that when you do put in a research grant or when you are going for these bigger projects, like, you've had the time to fully develop them rather than it being a kind of like mad dash. Oh, well, I have to find something because funding's running out in 6 months.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, that really, really makes a lot of sense. And also, thank you for being honest about it. It's not always positive. We don't always get good news. Yeah, academia is lots of applying for pots of funding here and there. And yeah, so thank you for being honest about that, because I think as researchers, especially on podcasts, on Twitter, we often share the good news, but it's good to acknowledge that there is often bad news. So now onto your work. So I understand that a key part of your research focuses on the role of educational apps in early education. Can you tell us a bit more about what is the current evidence in this area? What do we know about how those apps work with young people?
Yeah, for sure. So first research grant that we did apply for, so this was funded by the Nuffield Foundation. Another kind of behind the scenes story, I found out that we were successful in getting the grant on my birthday in lockdown. So it was a kind of like, yay, oh God, we're still in lockdown kind of moment. But yeah, it was definitely good news on that day. And yeah, so that project gave us some money to be able to do a two-part project. And the first part was to do a systematic review on educational maths apps in the first 3 years of primary school. So in the UK, that would be children aged 4 to 7. But then because we took a global view, that could also, the age range expands beyond 4 to 7, because not every country obviously follows the same starting age. Or in places, say like in Malawi, they follow an ability-based system. So you might end up having older children in younger years.
Oh, I see.
Because often they will repeat years, or there's high levels of absenteeism, so they get held back and things like that. So.
And a systematic review, sorry, so that means that you're reviewing the evidence that's out there already?
Yes, you pull together all the keywords that you think that are related to your research question, and then you develop a line of code which brings those all together, and you then basically are throwing out a big fishing net almost. And you're trying to collect as many of the different fish or studies, as you might say. You kind of collect them all, as many as you possibly can. But then at the same time, you might end up picking up a lot of unrelated things. You know, your search string or your net might pull up, let's say, 5,000 studies, but actually you're only interested in, say, 50 of them. And so you've got to go, yeah. You've got to be very systematic of, you know, which studies do you keep, which studies do you not keep. And so when you do a systematic review, it's really important that you set out that criteria, or like your protocol. We pre-registered it beforehand, so that it's almost like a recipe and you follow it precisely. You don't, because sometimes, particularly when I was doing some of the screening myself, I'd be looking at some of the screens and I'm like, oh, that's really interesting. Oh, well, let's include that one. And I'm like, no,
it doesn't
explicitly meet the criteria. So, you know, we had the pile of studies that did meet the criteria, and then I had another pile of studies that I'm like, oh, those are interesting. I'll read those another time. So you really have to be focused. But the idea of applying that methodology is exactly that. You are able to pull together all that is known on a particular research question. But off the basis of some of the advice from our advisory board, we actually expanded the net. We threw in a bigger net, shall we say, in that we were, sometimes when you do systematic reviews, you'll often see that they just focused on, say, the experimental design. So things like RCTs, so randomized control trials, or QEDs, which are quasi-experimental designs. And the reason for that is because they're considered the higher level of evidence. But then the problem is with those kind of studies is that sometimes they miss the nuance around, say, for example, how are children actually engaging with the technology? So that's where qualitative designs might come in, or they tend to look at the overall progress of the group rather than how do individual children respond to a particular intervention, which is when you might want study designs such as single case designs. So, you know, because we wanted to have a holistic overview of the current evidence, we cast a wider net and we included all kinds of studies. We weren't restrictive to just the, you know, the randomized control trials and the quasi-experimental designs. It made for a better paper, but it made it really difficult for synthesizing, I'm not going to lie. But it did.
Yeah, and it's just so much to read as well, I imagine.
No, definitely. Well, yeah, for sure. But then, you know, my advice to PhD students is always find a topic that you're truly, truly passionate about. And I think that advice still spans for any postdocs, anyone doing it, you know, going for a big project, because, you know, it does take up a huge portion of your time. And if you're not, you know, truly invested or truly interested in it, it does get very boring. But, you know, I have found my passion, and I'm safe to say I didn't find it boring, but it was certainly a lot of reading. So, yeah, we found through this process, we found 50 studies that had looked at evaluating educational maths apps with children in the first 3 years of school. In terms of the research methods that had been used, as we expected, there were a large proportion of studies that had primarily used these more experimental methods. But there is starting to be like an emerging evidence base, which is looking at how are children responding to the technology. So like I say, with these more qualitative designs and these more single case designs, which I think are really helpful in terms of advancing the field, particularly for working with children that may have additional needs. If we swing right back to the very first story that I told you, if we were, say, working with the young boy that I used to work with, if he was part of a larger trial, how he responded to the intervention would be lost amongst the sea of everybody else. And so it would be it's really difficult to then ascertain, well, who is the intervention working for? You know, RCTs are very good at answering, does the intervention work, yes or no? They don't then always go into the, yeah, but how does the intervention work? Why does it work? Who's it working for best? And in what circumstances? And that's where you need the additional methods. And again, I think that also then reflects into the results that we found in terms of the broader population. So the vast majority of the studies that have been done have worked with typically developing children, sometimes mixed abilities. And that was some of my own work as well. But there's very little evidence, at least for children that have special educational needs or children with specific learning difficulties, particularly relating to math. So I'm sure you know what dyslexia is. It's specific learning difficulty with learning to read. And the equivalent for maths is dyscalculia. And there are similar rates of prevalence for both learning difficulties. But yet what we know about dyscalculia is so much less.
Yeah, that's not talked about, is it? That's not a common term.
For sure. And that's, you know, then feeds into the kind of interventions that are available, you know. And so a lot of people, you know, at least when I came into the research around, you know, educational apps, it was, you know, the popularity has just boomed in the last sort of 10 years. But yet we have no solid evidence of, do these kind of interventions work for children with dyscalculia or specific mathematical difficulties? Now, it could be that maybe our age range was too young, and maybe it's that they've not had a formal diagnosis yet. But even still, there's, you know, if we have looked at the literature to see if there's a, you know, looked at wider age ranges. But even still, there's so fewer studies compared to the typically developing children. And if we're really trying to, you know, make a difference for the kids that need it most, you know, we need to be moving in those kind of areas. And I guess what's really helpful with doing a systematic review is that at least from when we finished the searches in January 2021, we know that at least up until that point, we've covered every study that has been published in that area. And so it's really helpful for then for essentially taking stock of what we already know, but importantly then making the next step in terms of identifying where are the directions for future research and where should we be focusing next. And I really think that at least in moving forwards, we really need to expand into more for understanding who the apps are working for best and really trying to target the children most in need.
Yeah, that sounds like, of course, from what you've said, absolutely. So you've talked a lot about like the apps more like generally, and I know as a former teacher, there are so many apps out there that claim to be educational. So how do we know which apps will help young people to learn, perhaps especially in maths, but also more generally?
It's a really good question, Emily, and one that we tried to address in the second part of that Nuffield project that I was just describing. In that first part, we identified 77 of the apps that had been evaluated across 50 studies. And of those 77, we were able to access 23. And the reason why there was a big drop was because sometimes the apps were only available in America, because that's where a lot of the research has been conducted. Also, sometimes researchers will develop apps, and it's purely for research purposes to try and get at mechanisms of learning and things like that. And they're not always available. They're not always commercially available. So we had the sample of 23 apps. And what we did was we did a content analysis of those apps. And the content analysis had two parts. So in the first, well, actually, no, it had three parts. The first part, we looked at the type of app that it was. So often people will be like, oh, yeah, apps are just, they're all the same, right? Like, it's a thing that's on your phone or on your tablet.
Yeah.
But actually, in terms of the content and the pedagogy that is involved, they can be categorized into different categories. So you've got what's probably the most popular one, which are called practice-based apps. So these are apps that encourage children to basically practice and repeat different concepts to, you know, help them acquire the knowledge in that area. So, you know, if it was, say, learning to add to five, there would be, say, you know, 10 or 15 different activities that are encouraging the practice and retrieval of that particular skill, which then you're aiming to get to fluency, which is a key part of mathematical development. But then further to that, you've then got game-based apps, which are very similar to practice-based apps in terms of the principles of this kind of practice and retrieval and fluency, but it's embedded within a story-like narrative, or so it could be that they're about to go on their adventure, and that, you know, if they collect all the stars, then, you know, they're going to go on their moon mission or things like that. And it's all about kind of, it's all about engaging and encouraging children to, you know, to take part and to be immersed in their learning experience. But then you've also got other apps, such as productive based apps, which is where children can create their own learning content. So they can take pictures of, say, their environment, and they can be like, look, this is a circle, or this is a square. It's still an app and they're still doing math, so it still comes under the umbrella of educational maths apps, but the kind of the learning activity that is involved is very, very different. And so we were interested in looking at, well, what types of apps have been evaluated and how is that then also linked to children's learning? And then in the second part of the content analysis, we looked at the kind of math skills that were covered. So if I was to say to you, maths, what kind of skills do you think that children need to have to learn math?
Well, definitely, you mentioning that made me think of counting, and my godson using an app which has like blocks and they like add together a bit like Tetris stars, so definitely counting.
Yeah, for sure. And that is definitely one of the most popular responses. You know, when we think of maths, we think of numbers, you know, so things like counting, adding, subtracting, multiplying, you know, how we use maths every day. But also maths is broader than that. You know, you've got
like the shape that you mentioned.
Absolutely. Yeah. Shape, geometry, even things like spatial rotation and spatial skills, they're all key parts of a holistic approach to mathematical development. And so what we wanted to do was also look at what skills are included in the apps, and are they giving children the kind of the diet of maths that they need? And then in the final part of the content analysis, we also wanted to look at some of the app design features. So in the time between us applying for the grant and getting the grant, there was a big, probably because of COVID, there was a massive surge of interest in app-based learning, which is great. It meant that I had a lot of interesting work to read, and it really helped shape the approach that we took. So essentially, there's been a lot of work that's tried to look at what features are conducive to a good maths app. And we synthesized across these different frameworks and tried to look at where the similarities and the differences were, and then use that to create the initial coding framework. So we were looking for things like feedback. So, you know, if a child got an answer right or wrong, you know, how did the app respond? We were also looking at opportunities for leveling. So, you know, did children follow the same journey all the way through, or was it in any way adaptive? So did it get easier or harder based on how they how well they were doing or not doing in the app? So yeah, we had a list of different features that we were looking for. And so in the first part of the content analysis, we were purely just looking at it on a descriptive level. We were just essentially mapping the picture out and saying, like, you know, what is it that has been evaluated so far. And the kind of the key headlines were that the most popular apps that have been evaluated so far are the practice-based ones that I mentioned at the start, but also the most popular areas of maths that have been covered are the number skills, so things like number representation and counting. And then in terms of the design features, a lot of apps did have different types of feedback, but there was also quite a lot of variation. So in terms of feedback, it could be motivational, so it can be like things like great job, well done, keep going, or try again. Or it can also be corrective, so if a child gets an answer right or wrong, it will tell them why it's wrong or what they need to do to change their or how to improve. And then in terms of leveling, there's different types. So we found apps that had taken a programmatic approach to leveling, which is where it is adaptive, so it gets either easy or harder based on how they're responding, which is the more dynamic form. Or it can be a static form where children complete a quiz at the beginning, and then based on their performance on that, it will set the child at a starting point that meets their needs in that moment, versus a more free-form approach to leveling, where although there's a suggested curriculum, children could pick and choose which one or like which topics that they wanted to do that day. Now you can see that there could potentially be pros and cons to all of those different approaches with feedback and leveling. So what we then wanted to do as a follow-up from that content analysis was to look at how are these design features linked to children's learning outcomes from the systematic review. So we used a method called qualitative comparative analysis, and what it stands for, the acronym is QCA. So if I refer to QCA, that's what I'm referring to. So QCA methods are really helpful for being able to look at what are the combinations of features, rather than just a kind of a linear model that you might have in other methods where you might say, does feedback or does corrective feedback underpin learning? Well, it might do, but actually maybe it's the combination of the corrective feedback and the programmatic leveling where it's adaptive to children get when they respond, so they get easier or harder. So the QCA method allowed us to look at, was it the individual features themselves, or was it the combination of features? And I think that, at least for the current evidence base and where we are in terms as researchers in this field, I think that's an important contribution in terms of looking at the combinations of features rather than just a single based approach. And what we found from that QCA study was that it was the corrective feedback, so explaining why the answer was right or wrong, combined with a personalized leveling approach. So whether that be the static or the dynamic approach, those as long as children were on a personalized learning journey that was scaffolded by the apps that had those features and those features combined, those were the ones that had enhanced learning outcomes. They had the strongest learning outcomes from the systematic review that we'd found in part one. So if I was, you know, when teachers or parents ask me, you know, are there any apps that you recommend? And I always hesitate to answer that question. Yeah. Because I'm always like, you know, some apps have been evaluated, which is fantastic, but some haven't. And maybe they're just not at that stage of their journey. That's obviously not to disregard the research that has been done for specific apps. And, you know, we do point them in that direction. But it's really important, at least from a generalizable point of view, to look at, well, OK, well, what are the features that we should look out for? So it's really helpful to be able to point them in that direction in terms of, like, you know, look for the features of leveling, look for the features of feedback. But also, you know, more broadly, look for the app content in terms of the math skills. Are they covering the things that you you need and want to cover within your classroom or your home. And hopefully it might be included in the program notes, but we have put together an infographic for teachers that, you know, I think it's got 5 or 6 different steps of these are the key things to look for in educational apps, because
Yes, that will be included in the program.
Great stuff. But it is genuinely a wild west out there. You know, when we came up with this 3-step framework to evaluate the apps that have been previously studied in research, we also then tried to apply it to the top 25 maths apps in the Apple App Store and in the Google Play Store. And I think 6 of the 25 apps that were, you know, considered the most popular had no maths content, which is just crazy. You know, so if you're a parent and you were to search...
They said that they were maths apps.
Yeah, yeah. So
but they didn't have maths content.
So if you search maths in the Apple App Store, it will pop up, you know, these are the most... And you search by popularity. It will give you a list of all the most popular ones. 6 within the top 25 have been tagged as maths for including maths content. But when we played with them and we were looking at them, we were like, this doesn't have any maths in it. And so it's really, you know, you sort of second guess yourself as a researcher. You're like, have I missed something? Am I using this wrong? Mm. You know, and so, you know, we were able to look at it in a very critical way and say like, okay, and this is fine. We were able to figure out, but imagine being a parent or a, you know, I would assume teachers would feel much more confident in knowing whether something has maths or not. But particularly if you're a parent and you're not really sure, you know, or you've brought the app thinking, you know, it's labelled as maths, but of course it has maths. And actually, it's not as, unfortunately, it's not as straightforward as that.
It sounds so useful for, as this podcast is named, it, like, your research is for the real world. It sounds so impactful and so useful. And I'm thinking about my experience as a languages teacher and people using language learning apps and all of the features that you've mentioned of apps. It sounds quite transferable as well to different age groups and different subject apps. It sounds like such a useful tool. So I look forward to looking more at that resource that we'll have in the show notes. Thank you. But I'm aware that we've focused on those features of the apps. So what other factors should we be considering when using maths apps with young people?
Yeah, no, it's really, really good question. So as part of that infographic that I also just mentioned, one of the things that we do talk about is the language that's included within the apps, particularly within math. So again, at the very beginning, I said that I did a study in Brazil as part of my PhD. And the key sort of contribution from that paper was trying to look at, well, how does children's language proficiencies impact on how well they're able to learn from the educational maths app? And so the school that I was working in was a bilingual Brazilian Portuguese and English school. So we had one group of children using the apps in English, one group of children using the apps in Brazilian Portuguese, and then a third group of children that just had normal maths practice. So they didn't have any engagement with the app, at least during the intervention period. And what we found was that the children that used the apps, whether they were in English or Brazilian Portuguese, they did just as well. But when we looked at their language proficiencies, children that had stronger skills in the language of instruction, so that would be English when they use the apps in English or Brazilian Portuguese when they use the apps in Brazilian Portuguese, those children that had the stronger language skills made more progress through the apps. Mm. Now it seems quite simple, because when you then looked at some of the content, for example, let's say there's an array of, say, footballs, basketballs and cricket balls. If the question is, how many footballs are there? If you don't understand the word or have the vocabulary for football, then you're not able to answer that question. And that's not a reflection of your mathematical skills. It's a reflection of your language abilities. And because within app-based learning, a lot of apps will have high language support. So maybe they'll model the answer that children need to give, or they'll give examples.
Yeah, photos.
Yeah, yeah. Or you can repeat the instructions, and sometimes they'll rephrase the instructions and they will use different vocabulary. But sometimes they won't. But also sometimes those language supports can be quite limited. If you have got a child that is still developing their language skills, then they're going to probably need additional supports to be able to understand the content of the app. You know, if you think in a normal classroom, if a child doesn't understand your question, you know, just as I'm talking to you now, like I'm using gesture, or you can use intonation, or you rephrase the question, you've not got those additional linguistic supports as you would in an app-based situation. And so there's been further research that has been done by my old PhD supervisor, Nicola Pitchford, that's found similar issues. So, and there's been other studies that have looked at, say, interventions or mathematical interventions that have been implemented on a one-to-one basis by a teacher rather than by an app. And in those situations, children that have the weaker language skills respond better. And so my advice, you know, other factors that you might wish to consider is like, well, what's the child's language skills? Can they understand the content that is being presented to them? If they can't, what additional supports do they need to either use the app, or is it a case of they need a different type of intervention? You know, yeah. When I started this research back in 2013, I was always sort of scared that, you know, someone would pick it up and be like, you know, Laura Outhwaite says that all teachers will be replaced by an iPad. And that's absolutely not the case at all. You know, I've always seen these kind of approaches to interventions to support as being a, it's part of teachers and parents' wider toolbox, you know, as long as we absolutely, can be like, yeah. These, we've got good solid evidence that, you know, this tool works, but at the same yeah. time, you could also use this tool or this tool. And it's about giving teachers and parents and ultimately the children themselves as well, the choice and the options to get children to where they need to be in terms of their, in terms of their basic math skills. So yeah, language is a key point, but also dosage. So, you know, when we, in a lot of the research, you'll find that studies will be like, oh, we implemented the apps for, let's say, 10 minutes a day for 4 days a week for 6 weeks. And quite often that's more of a, it's a practical issue. So it's because, you know, there was only 6 weeks in which to conduct the study, you know, or there's only 10 minutes of the school day that the teachers were able to implement the intervention. But that doesn't always be, that isn't always conducive to like, well, what's the optimal dosage? How much content or how much play do children need to have in order to reach the goal of, you know, acquiring that specific mathematical concept? And so some of the work that my PhD student Zara Siddiqui is doing is looking at the log data that is collected by apps to try and look at what's the optimal dosage for a 3-year-old, for a 4-year-old, for a 5-year-old, for a 6-year-old, and how that optimal dosage may vary across development is another kind of a key question. We don't have the answers yet, but I did want to give Zara a plug because she's doing some fantastic work in this area, and it's definitely, you know, a space in the research that is definitely one to watch for sure.
And it, what you've just said there, it makes complete sense with what you said previously. There won't be a, there's a magic amount of time for everyone. It won't be across the board, will it?
No, absolutely, absolutely. And so if we want to be giving, you know, parents, teachers, you know, other stakeholders, evidence-based recommendations in a simplest form, but in as accurate as possible, you know, we need to go beyond just having does it work questions. You know, we need to look at the more of the nuances as well, for sure.
It sounds like really, really useful work, and I look forward to following it in the future. On that topic of screen time, what you call dosage, it got me thinking about screen time though. So I'm aware that parents or caregivers and teachers listening to this might be asking questions, well, hang on, what about screen time? So what advice or solutions would you have for people who are concerned about screen time but also trying to balance that with learning apps?
Yeah, no, for sure. And it again, like these have all been fantastic questions, and you know, all ones that are really important to answer. And I think when it comes to screen time, I think it's really important to try and shift away from the quantity of screen time and mm-hmm. focus more on the quality and the quality of the content. What is it that they're actually doing? You know, playing an hour worth of Candy Crush is definitely not the same as, you know, playing with a maths app or a second language app like you mentioned as well. And so it's looking at the quality of the content. But also there's different types of apps. And so you can still have the benefits of app-based learning without actually the children being the ones interacting with the apps themselves. So in the second part of the Nuffle project that I mentioned earlier about in terms of the different types of apps, there's another kind that's, you know, has been less studied, but is definitely an area that is emerging, is what we've called parent-based apps. So these are apps where they basically have a bank of ideas for parents, caregivers or teachers or adults in children's lives. They have this bank of ideas of games that they can play with young children that then involves the mathematical play or the learning activity happens outside of the technology-based context. And those, there was some work published in 2015 which showed that that approach to educational apps did have significant benefits for children's learning outcomes, but also it helped the parents who were feeling anxious about math themselves. And there's also been research that has kind of, as the kind of stepping stone to that, that showed that parents that were anxious about their own mathematical skills and anxious about doing maths activities, those anxieties then fed into children's attainment. And so if we can support parents to feel more confident in their math skills and, you know, feel more confident to integrate maths into their everyday environments with their young children, it can then have knock-on consequences for the children themselves. And we can still achieve our goal of helping as many kids as we can feel confident and, you know, do well in their basic math skills. And so we've tried to build on this research at the moment. So during COVID, Dr. Jo van Hoevegen, who I mentioned earlier, her and I, with one of her PhD students, Erica Ranzantono, got some funding from UCL Enterprise to take some games that Jo and Erica had previously created and put that into an app-based format. So we've called it Maths at Home. And over the last couple of years, we've been working together to develop Maths at Home. So we've now got a full prototype. It's got 25 evidence-based maths games within the app, four different levels. So, you know, you've got it's the easy level, which, you know, is aimed at younger children, but it can also be used by children that maybe are older but that are struggling with their math skills. So it's not like, you know, it's specifically for this age group. You know, we've tried to keep it as accessible as possible. And so, yeah, we've essentially got 25 times, well, we've got 100 games or 100 versions of these games within the app that parents can play with their children using resources that they have within their home in their everyday interactions. You know, you don't need to go out and spend lots of money on big, expensive toys or resources. You know, you can do maths activities going on a walk to school, you know, find the shapes in your environment, you know, or when you've got bath time, count your fingers, count the toes, you know, you can practice these everyday math skills all the time, you know. And it's what me and Jo are really passionate about is encouraging parents and adults to see the maths in everyday life. You know, there's research showing that parents will read to their children every day, but they will only do a maths activity with their children once a week. And that's on average. So there might be slightly more, there might be slightly less. But the overall picture is that maths is much less celebrated and encouraged compared to literacy. Now, I'm not saying by any means, I also don't want to, you can imagine the headline, Laura says literacy is, you know, we don't need to focus on literacy. That's not what I'm saying at all. It is just as, it is important as well. It's, of course it is, you know, and I'm not saying that math should overtake literacy or language, but they all go together, you know, and it's giving.
Well, as you said earlier, like the two complement each other. If you're using a math app, you need the literacy and vice. Yeah, like they work together. It's not a singular skill.
Absolutely. You know, and if you look at the broader picture in terms of, you know, the emphasis on literacy skills at the start of school, you know, we don't have the same for maths. And that's something that we've put forward as a policy priority within our research centre, is to try and encourage this more of an emphasis on early math skills and, you know, upskill people and encourage them to see the math in every day, because it doesn't, you know, it doesn't need to be matrix algebra in the bath. It's definitely not, you know, it doesn't need to be big. It doesn't need to be complicated. And it's encouraging those conversations and those play-based situations that, you know, is something that we really want to drive forward in the future.
Thank you, Laura. That's really interesting. And yeah, I think that kind of shift away from like screen time, which you imagine is like one-on-one, just the kid in a corner staring at the screen, it can be more of a whole family or engaged activity. Before you go, I wanted to ask you, you shared about your career so far, but I'm particularly interested in what you think is next for you. What are you hoping to do in the coming months and years?
Yeah, good question. So at the moment, we are currently piloting the Maths at Home app to understand what's its impact on both parents' self-efficacy, so their confidence for doing maths activities at home, but then also children's emergent maths outcomes as well. So we're currently recruiting, and in the first phase of pre-testing as part of the that project. So if there are any listeners that are interested either in taking part or in the results, please do contact me. You know, obviously very, very happy to share. So that's kind of in, that's my big focus at the moment. But also one of the things that I have been doing more recently is that, you know, being part of an interdisciplinary research centre like CPO has enabled me to, you know, learn from other colleagues and expand my networks in, you know, in ways that I didn't anticipate when I first moved to London. And so I've been able to expand into other areas of early childhood education and care. And so I've been working a lot with Claire Crawford to be looking at, you know, why should we be investing in early years, which is obviously a big political and priority at the moment. Yeah. So it's a big part of the this year's budget. You know, and I do see this work, you know, it feeds into each other, you know, because if parents or caregivers are looking after their children at home, or if children are going into daycare, people refer to childcare, will quite often refer to it as childcare. And it's not just childcare, it's early education, you know, and it's having tools that, you know, different adults in children's lives can use. And so I do see that there's a synergy across both strands of research. So yeah, but ultimately the goal is to stay in London. I have definitely gone back on my word, and you know, very happy here, very settled here, and yeah, very excited to see, you know, what the future holds at IOE. You know, there's lots of like really exciting work going on, and you know, I just feel hugely privileged to be part of it. And you know, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Nikki when I was back, when I think I was about 20 at the time, you know, sort of like bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, and maybe a little bit too eager to get involved in research. But she definitely has shaped my career in a way that, you know, I didn't anticipate. But along the way, you know, I've met a number of really good mentors. You know, Jo's been a really close collaborator. You know, she's given me lots of support in terms of, you know, advice of like where we should apply for funding. But then also people that aren't within my immediate field. So when I first moved to UCL, I approached Chloe Marshall. She helped me a lot when I did my first grant application, getting advice and feedback on that. You know, Lindsay McMillan's been really helpful in terms of, you know, her leadership of CPO. And there's so many people that I could listen. Just as I'm saying that, I'm like, oh, maybe I should stop because I'm definitely going to miss someone. But, you know, it takes a village. You know, it's not, research can be very solo. It can be, you know, and sometimes you can feel like a bit of a lone wolf. And I think that was probably emphasized during the COVID pandemic when we were in lockdown and, you know, you sat at home and you're trying to write your research paper or, you know, whatever it might be. But actually, you know, you need your mentors, you need your peers, and you need the people around you to build you up and support you, because it is a tough journey. And, you know, I'm just very grateful and privileged to have, you know, such a huge team of that support around me. And, you know, I wouldn't be able to do the research that we have done if it wasn't for them as well. So, yeah, big thanks to them as well.
I'm so pleased to hear it, and it's just been so interesting to learn more about your research and for you to be on the other side of the podcasting studio today. I've loved learning about your career and also just these features of apps that I just hadn't like thought about before. You just think about learning apps as quite one-dimensional, but now I'm going to be looking at them in a new way. So thank you so much for that, and thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Emily. It was a real privilege, and like I say, I was a bit nervous, but definitely settled into it, and it was really great to be on this side, and thanks for all your interesting questions.
You can follow Laura on Twitter at LAOuthwaite. That's LAOUTHWAITE, to learn more about her research. Some of what we've covered today is also available in the episode notes. If you've enjoyed this episode, we have an archive of 19 past seasons. Search IOE Podcast from wherever you get your podcasts to find episodes of Research for the Real World, as well as more podcasts from the IOE. And a quick favour before you go, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, we'd really appreciate it if you could give the IOE Podcast a rating. 5 stars would be nice if you're enjoying the show. And that will help us to reach more people who are interested in hearing about such important work. I'm Emily, thanks for listening.
Research for the Real World is produced by IOE Marketing and Communications and IOE Research Development. The theme music was created by Rob Cochran. Tatiana Sotero-Diaz is the series advisor, Amy Leibowitz is the series producer, and Jason Ilagan is the executive producer of the IOE podcast.
Thanks so much for downloading and listening to this IOE podcast.